Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, what progressive ideas could Joe Biden implement in his first months in office? Our first guest today has some suggestions. And later, a local Republican official has become one of the few Republicans in office to speak out against conspiracy theories about the November 3rd election. We'll talk with him live later. But first, one listener comment about a portion of a recent program where we discussed the rising tension in the country over such issues as mask wearing. Here's what one listener had to say.
My name's John, former Tampa resident. Living in North Carolina now. You had a caller, a woman, I think, who said she was at a flea market with a mask on, and someone apparently decided that it was up to them to try to get this woman sick. They're walking around without a mask. Anyway, I think you remember the call. So if I understand the situation correctly, it sounds like the guy, whether or not he knew he was sick, was intentionally trying to get this woman sick, which, in other words, is intentionally trying to harm this woman. I'm no lawyer, but from what I understand, you know, intent and trying to harm someone is assault. So, you know, basically this guy attempted some kind of assault on this poor lady. People are getting nuts, man. I don't know what's going on. I hope that lady's okay. And your shows are great. Thanks.
Well, that's a comment that came in overnight. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. President-elect Joe Biden is coming into office with a mounting COVID crisis, a struggling economy, and an angry electorate. Our guest says the new president should construct a popular bread-and-butter agenda that works for most Americans. He urges Biden to create programs that give people something to vote for instead of something to vote against. Otherwise, he warns, Biden will suffer the same fate that Barack Obama suffered in his first midterm election, a major loss of Democratic seats in Congress. Our guest is Branko Marcetic, who's a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine and the Leonard C. Goodman Institute for Investigative Reporting Fellow. He's working on a forthcoming book about Joe Biden. I spoke with him yesterday about his article, which is headlined, Instead of Repeating the Obama Administration, Biden Must Do Better. Here's how. Branko Marcetic, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you wrote a piece that was carried in These Times. I want to ask you about it. The headline that I've got here says, Instead of repeating the Obama administration, Biden must do better. Here's how. First of all, do you think that Biden is right now on track to maybe repeat the Obama administration? Because a lot of Obama administration insiders are joining the Biden team. Do you think he's about to do that?
I would say if I was to put money on it, it looks more like we are getting an Obama 2.0 presidency. You know, a lot of the same people coming back, a lot of the same sort of interests guiding the policymaking of the next presidency. You have now, instead of Goldman Sachs, you've got BlackRock, another financial firm, and obviously Biden's top White House advisor was drawn from BlackRock. You also have people like Michelle Flournoy and Tony Blinken, people who served under Obama and who were, you know, played a role in some of the foreign policy, in my view, blunders of that administration. They seem to now be coming back under the Obama, under the Biden administration. And then people also like John Kerry and Ernest Moniz, who has not been named yet, but is one of the people that Biden is supposedly floating. They're also coming back. So, you know, if Rahm Emanuel also manages to get put back into the fold, I think we've sort of got ourselves, you know, quite an Obama reunion. And unfortunately, it's the people in the Obama administration that I think were responsible for some of the failures of that administration, you know, narrowing the political ambitions of Obama and in many different fields, and that ultimately kind of led to Trump rising. So it's not looking great, but it's still the transition, and maybe things can be turned around.
Well, on top of that, at least Obama had a Senate that had a Democratic majority. Biden doesn't even have that. So in light of that, how does Biden kind of resist the impulse to be a moderate? I mean, I think what you're getting at in your piece is that you want him to be more of an FDR-type Democrat.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think he can take some pages out of Trump's book, you know, not in the sense of many of the things that Trump did, but certainly in the sense of just using broad executive power to take care of people during this crisis, to make sure that people, you know, aren't going for healthcare and wanting for healthcare, aren't being evicted en masse and the like. You know, the Obama administration in many ways had 2 years where it controlled, you know, both House of Congress and the presidency. And after those 2 years, they lost the House in a big way. And that was kind of the end of Obama's really grand ambitions. And as you say, Biden doesn't really have that. But what will be even worse is if Biden ends up going into 2022 and loses those midterms, and the House goes to the Republicans, and then you have not just divided government, but really a mostly Republican-controlled government, with Biden sort of having to cut much worse deals than he has now. My argument in that piece is basically that yes, the Senate is likely lost to Biden and the Democrats, but there are measures that he can take that go around Congress to be able to you know, improve people's lives good enough going into 2022 that maybe people go, hey, actually, this guy deserves my vote. He deserves my support. You know, for example, Trump did a variety of executive actions that protected people from evictions, that transferred money to people when unemployment insurance had run out, that had actually covered people who were uninsured to make sure that the COVID healthcare costs were covered. As just a few examples, and those orders were not enough. They were often, you know, inadequate or had loopholes or were sort of easily gamed. But it did show that there is a possibility to find these kind of this broad legal authority for these pretty expansive actions. And if Trump can do it, you know, Trump, who is a very right wing and in practice a very anti-government president, if he can do that, then surely Biden, who is a Democrat, who's supposed to support the government being able to step in and protect people, can go even further than Trump did.
You know, it's funny because just a few years ago, Republicans were complaining about President Obama's use of executive orders. As you point out, President Trump has used lots of executive orders and really done a lot of things to move forward his agenda. So you think the space is there, the political space is there. If the Republicans haven't objected to Trump using the executive orders, then the political space is there for Biden to exercise more executive authority.
Absolutely. I mean, the GOP has for at least, you know, 30 to 40 years been this militantly anti-government party, this party that says that the government can't do a single thing right, that shouldn't really do many things, that should stay out of people's lives as much as possible. And yet, Trump, who is probably the most popular Republican president, only in terms of his popularity among Republicans, you know, in I don't know how many years, from the start of his administration to the end, he has done things that any ordinary Republican over the past, you know, four decades would not have done, would have balked at doing. You know, some of those executive orders that I mentioned being among them. And you know, Republicans did object to some of this. Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania said something along the lines of, well, you know, if Trump does this, then no Democrat is going to want to be called less generous than Trump. Sort of saying that, look, if you do this now, the next guy is going to end up doing something way, way beyond what you're doing now. Yeah, I think he's absolutely right. Even though he's a Republican, he sort of said that as a warning. I think Biden should take that as sort of a guiding light, I suppose, for his administration is at the very, very, very least not to be stingier than Trump. You know, find some of these legal authorities. You know, Trump's executive order on the eviction ban, for instance, what it used was, it was an obscure statute from, I think, 1946 to do with pandemic handling. And it said that in a public health crisis like this, where there's a virus going around, the CDC can order people to stay in their homes as a sort of a public health measure. And so Trump did this not as a public health measure, but as a way to keep people housed so that their landlords weren't evicting them because they couldn't afford rent. So there's obviously room. I'm sure that, I'm not a legal expert, but I'm sure there are numerous statutes in the book that a clever team of policy wonks and legal experts could dig up and find similar legal authority for a whole host of similar executive orders.
Well, we're talking with Branko Marcetic, who's a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. We're talking about a piece that he wrote for In These Times, and the piece is called Instead of Repeating the Obama Administration, Biden Must Do Better, Here's How. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Just recently here in Florida, statewide, even though the state voted for President Trump by about 3%, 61% of voters here in Florida supported a pretty strong increase in the minimum wage over 6 years to $15 an hour. That has always been part of the kind of progressive Democratic agenda, but aren't Biden's hands tied when it comes to raising the minimum wage? Let's say that the minimum wage is popular even among Republicans. What could Biden do to change the national minimum wage?
Yeah, so certainly if he went through Congress, that would be the case. But one advantage that Biden has is being the head of this enormous, very powerful and very lucrative entity known as the federal government, is that he can use his executive power to deny federal contracts to firms that, you know, fall short of a whole bunch of standards. And he can decide what those are. One might be paying a $15 minimum wage. That was an idea that was floated by Bernie Sanders during the presidential campaign, and there's no reason that Biden couldn't just take it for himself now. And you could attach a whole host of other conditions to that. You know, you could have certain basic labor standards, like holiday pay and the like. You could even say that, for example, with the crisis in the Amazon happening right now, with the deforestation there reaching a really critical point, and it's a very scary point. And this is an issue that Biden has actually name-checked during the presidential campaign. Biden could even say, you know what, I'm denying federal contracts to firms that have the Amazon rainforest as part of their supply chain. That could be one way to sort of slow that deforestation. So I think that is a really useful tool that can be used in a variety of ways. And it would affect a lot of different companies because so many of the biggest companies in the world, let alone the United States, are federal contractors. Even a company like Walmart, you know, which is known as one of the most abusive employers in the United States. It has a terrible, terrible track record on labor rights. They are a contractor, and they just a few years ago paid a very large sum of money into the hundreds of millions, I believe, to avoid being blacklisted over a bribery scandal by the federal government. So that gives you an idea of how important these government contracts are, even to firms as huge as Walmart. So I think there, Biden has a lot of latitude to go to possibly force these places to pay people a decent wage and treat their workers like human beings. Mm.
What about college debt, which is a big issue for many people? And I think it was what drew in a lot of young people to vote for Bernie Sanders, and maybe Biden got some help from young people during this election. But does Biden have any, is there any path that Biden could take to cut back that enormous amount of student debt that many people have?
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, this is what legal experts are saying, is that this is really an issue where Biden could just, with the stroke of a pen, eliminate student debt. And, you know, one of the frustrating things is that I think Biden's proposal right now is something like eliminate $10,000 of federal student loans for people in certain, you know, certain conditions, people who meet a certain standard of hardship. I think right now Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren are proposing a more expansive one that's around $50,000 per person. But, you know, I mean, why not just even go beyond that? You know, instead, especially because when you means test these programs, when you say, well, we're only going to do this to people who make this amount of money or exclude people of this background and this and that, you really engender division and resentment in a way that you don't when you sort of go for a more universalist approach. That one is I don't know how likely it's going to be that it will happen, but to me it's a no-brainer because it's one that really he can do very easily without having to have Congress involved at all. Obviously, the problem with student debt will remain as long as the for-profit university system stays in place. But at the very least, as a kind of gesture towards fairness and justice, and as a economic stimulus measure, it just seems like why would you not do this?
Mm. You also think Joe Biden should expand Social Security. Can he do that as president via executive order? And what would be the benefit of expanding Social Security benefits?
Well, so I don't believe he can do it by executive order. Although, you know, if he really wanted to test how far he could go, he could try it. Certainly, presidents have gotten away with far more outrageous things by just signing a piece of paper. But you know, my idea was that at the very least, he could put expansion of Social Security into some sort of, whether it's a coronavirus relief bill or some sort of bill that will no doubt be blocked by Mitch McConnell, you know, a must-pass spending bill of some kind, and basically create a standoff because, you know, basically putting the Republicans on the record. Listen, your voters are overwhelmingly older. They, you know, they receive Social Security. Social Security is a very popular program. I think expanding it is very popular from some of the polling I've seen. And not only that, but there is a really terrible epidemic of elder poverty in the United States. You know, while there are definitely wealthy older people that exist, there are also a lot of poor people who are struggling to get by and who, you know, their Social Security check is just barely letting them hang on. So expanding it would not only be a moral thing to do as a political act, it would force the Republicans into a corner because it would ask them to basically either say no to a bill because maybe they don't like some of the other stuff in it, but and so they have to veto basically expanding benefits, or they say, well, we don't want to annoy or anger our most loyal constituency, and so yes, we should try to we should vote for this even though we don't like all the other stuff because you know, the Social Security thing that'll be put around our necks when we run for the election in the midterms, and it'll be bad for us. Mm-hmm. And it has to be remembered that Biden actually did quite a bit better with older voters this time around and a lot of places. So overall, you know, look, it may not work out, but ultimately if the goal is to avoid the quote-unquote shellacking that Obama received in 2010 in the midterms, I think that is one sort of gambit that he could use to force a confrontation, a high-profile confrontation with the Republicans.
Yeah, and over the last few years, because inflation has been low, the Social Security checks have not increased that much, and more Americans are relying on Social Security alone in their time of retirement because retirement plans have gone away, and many employers don't really offer 401ks or 403bs or, you know, some sort of savings plan. Bronco, President Trump has already said he wants to bring troops home from our long war in Afghanistan and from Iraq. What would you do if you were Biden? What would you do about the ongoing wars in those two countries?
Well, I would avoid desperately getting back into those wars. That is kind of the concern, is that if Trump pulls out, and Trump, it seems like he's actually leaving a residual force, it's something like 2,500 people in Afghanistan. But if Trump pulls out, you know, the worry is that Biden would feel pressure to send them back in because obviously there is a very vast national security bureaucracy that kind of is more in favor of intervention in places like Afghanistan. I think this is wrong. I think it's wrong on the policy aspect. I mean, we just last year, the end of last year, we had the release of the Afghanistan papers that showed that basically the U.S. had been in Afghanistan for 2 decades without really having a clear strategy, without having any real progress, without even really knowing what it was doing anymore. It was just sort of this thing that no one wanted to be the person to pull out of. And so there's, you know, one, there's, it's pointless to stay there any longer. You know, there'll be a million reasons people point to, humanitarian reasons perhaps, but the thing is those were, have always applied, and people have always promised to pull out of those wars, and it's not going to change anytime now. There will never be a good time to leave. But beyond that, I mean, look, these wars are incredibly expensive. They've cost trillions of dollars, which incidentally is, you know, roughly the amount that now the U.S. owes, you know, in its debt. So if you're worried about fiscal responsibility, it makes sense to pull out. And also, that's very popular. I mean, the American public is really war weary. It's been decades of this stuff now. People being sent to countries that, you know, maybe their home communities have never even heard of until suddenly that they're spirited away to go and fight there. They come back traumatized and you know, maimed and maybe even killed sometimes. People are really tired of it. I mean, I think pulling out of Afghanistan and Iraq has something like, it's a majority support. I'm not going to tell you the exact number, but I think it's in the 60s, possibly the 70%. So that to me is a no-brainer. And you could go further. You could end the war in Yemen. You could start pulling out troops in other places, in North Africa, for instance. Whether Biden will do any of this, I think, is another question, but this is certainly what I would do.
One of the mysteries to me over the last few presidencies is the presidents continue to leave marijuana on the schedule of most dangerous drugs in the U.S., even though I think the support for criminalizing marijuana has long passed, even in the most conservative states. What do you think President-elect Biden, should do about marijuana?
Ideally, he would legalize it on a federal level. That was another idea that Sanders had in the suite of executive orders they put out. Whether that was actually possible, it's not clear. Legal experts at the time said that, look, that's all well and good to say, but the actual process of doing it is a little more complicated. And you know, that may well be true. It may not be that easy. But, you know, at the very least, Biden could direct parts of the federal bureaucracy, the Department of Justice, to direct agencies lower down not to prosecute marijuana violations. They could, generally treat it as something that even if they can't formally, classify it as a different schedule straight away, they can at least start to treat it as something different. As I've said, presidents and governments, law enforcement agencies, routinely will ignore certain crimes. Just look at the way that fraud on Wall Street was allowed to basically go unpunished after the 2008 crisis. It makes no sense to continue to go after people who use or are holding marijuana. And one thing you should definitely avoid is the practice that Obama did when he came in. He sort of, as an attempt to curry favor with conservatives, Obama was raiding pot dispensaries around the country, even if they were illegal on a state level, which was very outrageous and deeply unpopular, as you can imagine. That, at the very least, that makes no sense at this point. As you say, with Trump voting states even legalizing marijuana at the very least for medicinal uses, there's no advantage here anymore of treating this drug the way it's been treated for the past however many decades.
Well, we don't know whether or not President Obama We don't know whether or not President Biden, rather, is envisions himself as another President Obama or another Bill Clinton or another FDR. FDR famously said, I want to do all this stuff, but you're going to have to make me do it, suggesting that he needed movements at the grassroots to push him in this progressive direction. Do we have those movements in the country? And where do you think, I mean, given the fact that we started this conversation with Biden appointing many people from the Obama administration, many moderates, he hasn't appointed many progressives to his cabinet or to high posts yet. So what gives you any indication that Biden could even go in this direction?
Well, does that movement exist? That's a good question. We have been seeing the rise of various grassroots movements and grassroots energy on the left. You know, organizations like the DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, which has been growing exponentially basically every year since Trump and Sanders ran in 2016. And has been actually winning office around the country. It's slow, but it's happening. You've also got groups like Sunrise Movement and Justice Democrats and a whole bunch of other groups that are sort of increasingly confrontational with the Democratic establishment because they realize that Democratic politics, as usual, as it's been going, is really inadequate. And is one of the things that gave rise to Trump. Is it big enough at this point? I think it's not big enough, unfortunately. But one of the hopes that I have is having seen and reported on and been to the massive George Floyd protests that erupted this year, and seeing this massive coalition of people coming out to oppose police violence and to call for serious reforms to policing in the United States. I would hope that comes back. And unfortunately, I think it will, because there will no doubt be another police murder somewhere down the line, because nothing has really been changed since these protests really began under Obama. But I would also hope that something of that energy, maybe even those movements themselves, become something about bigger than just the police reform. Police reform is very vital, but that this movement flowers into something bigger that's generally about working class politics, that's generally about getting not just police reform but economic justice. Again, whether that's going to happen, I don't know, but I do see that there are parts of the Democratic left that are increasingly more likely now to challenge the party. And as you say, Biden, even if he really does want to do all this stuff, he needs the space created by movements on the ground. And so what I would suggest to people is there's been a lot of talk about once Trump is out, everyone can go back to sleep, everyone can go back to brunch, and things can go back to normal. I would say that as nice as that thought is, it's not true. Things are not going to go back to normal because we're living in very unnormal times. And Joe Biden, even at his best, is someone who is, I think, philosophically still very much a conservative. And he may not just do things or avoid doing things that are good, but he may actually do things that are actively bad and damaging and harmful. And people need to, far from sort of going to sleep and checking out of politics for another 4 years, I think people need to stay engaged, and they need to be just as willing to whether it's protests or challenging and calling their local lawmakers or what have you. They need to be doing all the stuff they did under Trump with Biden. If Biden ends up being only pressured from the right by right-wing groups who are anti-lockdown and anti-government and all this stuff, then that is the direction he's going to move. But if he's has more of a challenge, more pressure from the left, then he's more likely to move in that direction.
Bronco, is there anything else that you'd like to mention that I didn't ask you about?
No, I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I think there are other things that I named in the piece, and people should have a read of it. But, things like allowing the importation of drugs from overseas, that's another no-brainer that would really help people and make a measurable impact to people's lives. I mean, electorally, the Biden administration really should be looking to avoid that 2010 defeat. And, I think not just myself, but there's a lot of people kind of giving them advice. Whether they'll take it, I don't know. But as you said, it's not just about what they'll do. It's also about what are the people that are listening to this going to do. You know, are they going to just go back and stop following politics for 4 years, or are they going to stay engaged and really light the fire under this administration?
Bronco, where can people read your article?
It's at inthesetimes.com. It's In These Times. It's a Chicago-based magazine. And you can also find some of my writing in Jacobin Magazine as well.
Well, Bronco Marchetich, thank you very much for coming on WMNF.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll put a link to his article on our website. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Yesterday, Pasco County Election Supervisor Brian Corley, who happens to be a Republican, issued a statement criticizing the recent attacks on the electoral process. He said political pundits and some government officials have politicized the electoral process with baseless claims and misinformation intent upon undermining the election results. He said, went on to say that with every deep state conspiracy and illegitimate claim of fraud, our democracy sinks deeper and deeper into divisiveness. And Brian Corley, the election supervisor in Pasco County, joins us right now. Brian, welcome back to WMNF. Thank you for coming on.
Good morning.
So why did you issue the statement? Why did you feel that this needed to be said?
Well, it started with, you know, we saw a lot of emotions and claims leading up to the election, but post-election day, I started receiving a tremendous number of constituent emails and calls. It started with the Sharpie pen conspiracy. You know, I want to know my vote counted. I was forced to use a Sharpie pen. I'm a Republican. And, of course, I was, you know, debunked that. And then we went on to a myriad of other, you know, questions and inquiries. And then I saw it play out in other states. And you have to understand something. The elections community is of course, diverse in the fact that we are all different political persuasions, races, genders, but we are politically agnostic, politically neutral, or professional election administrators. And I know a lot of these my colleagues in other states, and to see them be vilified and attacked and be threatened, and quite honestly, the final straw was when I happened to catch Gabe Sterling from Georgia. You know, when you know it has to stop, just a great line, and that just resonated with me, and I contemplated it and thought about it. And I thought, you know, I've in 14 years, I've never made any sort of statement. We're not political, but unfortunately, the election administration has become the political focal point. And I just got tired, especially when I see individuals in my profession being threatened and their families having to have police protection for doing their jobs. And for what? To see individuals out there who have not won one single court case, but are never shy about holding a press conference talking about servers in Germany and Hugo Chavez and Sharpies and people voting who don't live there. And it was lunacy. And I couldn't take it anymore. I felt obligated to stick up for my profession and my colleagues. And let me just quick say this, though. You know, there is fraud. So anyone that tells you otherwise is being less than truthful. But the key word is here. It's not systematic. It's not widespread. I mean, even Attorney General Bill Barr said as much. If a top law enforcement individual in the country and the president's administration says that should be pretty definitive, but yet still it continues. So I just felt an obligation to speak out and just, you know, say the truth.
What kind of response have you gotten to the statement that you issued yesterday?
Well, I've gotten about 200 plus emails. I haven't had a chance to read yet, but there have been filling up my inbox overnight. And I expect a lot more, probably about 40 or 50 phone calls, messages rather. And, you know, I was told there was a lot of activity on social media. Someone shared with me that I guess former director of CISA, Chris Krebs, had retweeted. And quite honestly, that's a huge compliment because I have a lot of respect. We work very closely with DHS, and that's the irony. You know, I got to see Director Krebs speak many times. We worked very closely with the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, to shore up our cyber posture. The one area that we had concerns about was misinformation, and it stemmed from the 2016 Russian interference. And now we know it's other countries as well. And yet here we see misinformation coming from our own people in leadership and government and political pundits in our own country. So we're doing Vladimir Putin's bidding for him, and it's like a giant Jedi mind trick and were falling for it. The goal of the Russians in 16 was to polarize the electorate and to, you know, further erode voter confidence. Well, I think it's pretty safe to say a good chunk of the electorate is polarized and also doesn't have confidence because of what they're seeing on social media and seeing on the news from you know, those leadership positions. And that's just, it's lunacy. Some of the crazy allegations I've heard are just literally, you know, insane, and we're doing a big disservice to our country.
You mentioned Gabriel Sterling, who works for the Secretary of State's office in Georgia. He made that statement earlier this week saying this has got to stop. You quoted him in your statement when you issued it from the Pasco County Supervisor of Elections office yesterday. Have you gotten any? I mean, Sterling was talking about threats directed at the Georgia elections offices. Has Pasco County received any threats?
Not since Election Day. We had some veiled threats during the general election buildup, if you will. And we work with law enforcement, but not since then. I actually plan to call Mr. Sterling today. And if you haven't had the chance, when I watched him, you know, there's no agenda there. His voice was cracking. He was emotional. That was raw emotion, and that's heartfelt. And that just really, that was the final straw for me. That just, you know, just to see, to hear, you know, the great example, I have to have police protection, but, you know, the one individual works for Dominion, who's a contract employee, a young kid getting, you know, a noose and called treasonous, all because he was doing his job. And that was just very, very frustrating. But no, you know, thank God we have not. And I think it's great that individuals, and these are not just constituents, these are from what I'm told all over the country, they can email me, they can call me, they can chime in. That's their right. But obviously threats won't be tolerated. That's not going to fly well with yours truly.
Just one more question. We're talking with Pasco County Election Supervisor Brian Corley, who yesterday issued a statement criticizing the recent attacks on the electoral process. What does it do if a sizable number of people in the country adhere to this theory that there's some vast conspiracy within our electoral system, there's a deep state that controls it, and that, if the deep state wants to, they can manipulate votes. If that theory holds, at least among a portion of the electorate, what does it do to our electoral system?
It damages it, and it diminishes the value of our democracy. And, you know, there comes a tipping point. There's no going back. When you have individuals who, you know, are literally being fooled in a cult-like way with QAnon, that literally believe there's lizard people and you know, crazy things in pizza places that are completely just fabricated, that's very, very troubling. And so going forward, you know, I don't know. I'd like to think that we will, you know, snap out of it, but this divisiveness has to stop. I mean, you know, Abraham Lincoln said it best, the house divided cannot stand. And, you know, we need to be talking, you know, to each other, not at each other. And you know, it's okay to have disagreements. You know, our country was founded on dissent. I grew up in an Irish Catholic household. We had many good arguments growing up around the dining room table, but you didn't hold grudges. You didn't have Facebook where you go on and call someone an idiot or a moron because they disagree with you. And you know, we need to have a return of civility, quite frankly, in all levels of government and among Americans, myself included, all of us could just take it down. Like I like to say, we all need a giant chill pill. Everyone take it down a few notches. You know, I think back to September 11th and that horrendous day. But that night, so true of America, is always during tragedy a bright spot. And I always think back of that night when you had members of Congress. Didn't matter what political party they were, what, you know, race or gender, that was immaterial. They gathered and they spontaneously, you recall, held hands and saying, "God bless America," to show the world we're united. We need that moment. We need that unifying moment because, as I think I even said in my statement, is, you know, one of my favorite bands of all time is U2, and one of their songs, the lyric says, "There is no them, there's only us." You know, the enemy is not amongst us. We are on the same team, and we need just to remember that. Have your arguments, disagreements, it's all good, but just keep it civil.
Brian Corley, thanks a lot. I know you're busy, but thank you for joining us here on Radioactivity on WMNF.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian.
All right. Sure, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Brian Corley is the supervisor of elections in Pasco County. He was elected to that office. He's a Republican. And yesterday he issued a statement criticizing the recent attacks on the electoral process. He said political pundits and some government officials have politicized the electoral process with baseless claims and misinformation intent upon undermining the election results. He said, with every deep state conspiracy and illegitimate claim of fraud, our democracy sinks deeper and deeper into divisiveness. And we'll post that entire statement. It's much longer than what we read on our website at WMNF.org. Well, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's take a few phone calls, and I'll read a few emails and see where you want to take the conversation. I also want to play some audio from one of the hearings that was held this week on electoral fraud. We'll play some audio from that in just a little bit. And when I say electoral fraud, alleged electoral fraud. Let's go to Tim in Dunedin. Tim, thanks for calling. What would you like to comment about?
Hi, Rob. Thanks for the show. I was a question for Brian, but I just maybe a comment on this. Friends on the right that are watching videos out of Wisconsin and Michigan stating from people who are testifying saying that there was a lot of fraud, but I'm not sure of the source of these videos. However, have you heard about them? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks a lot.
Okay, sure. One of the claims being made is that there's an Edison County in Michigan where there was tremendous fraud, and then it was pointed out, and some of my conservative friends have sent me this allegation that there was fraud in a county named Edison in Michigan, and then other people sent me an email pointing out that there is no Edison County in Michigan. There was a hearing just a few days ago, and the star witness, this was in Michigan, was the woman we're about to hear. She is Melissa Carone, and she was the star witness in a hearing where Rudy Giuliani and this witness were speaking to members of the Michigan House of Representatives. And this is let's listen to just a little bit of the testimony. This is why Republicans continue to believe that there was a conspiracy in this election. Here's Melissa Carone on WMNF.
The poll book is completely off. Completely off.
Off that 30,000?
I'd say that poll book is off by over 100,000. That poll book, why don't you look at the registered voters on there? How many registered voters are on there? Do you even know the answer to that?
No, I guess I'm trying to get to the bottom
zero.
Of this here.
Zero. There's zero.
So my question then is if the...
Guess how many... Wait. What about the turnout rate? 120%?
Let's let Representative Johnson ask his question.
So the poll book number, there's two things that could happen here. Either the poll book number, if ballots were counted multiple times, there's two options. Option number one is that the poll book numbers are not going to match.
They don't.
The actual. Not by thousands and thousands of votes. That's not what we see right now.
Take a look again.
Option number two is that they essentially were filling in names of people who didn't vote.
Dead people, too?
So is that,
Representative Johnson ask his question, and then when he's done.
I thought that was his answer. Okay.
Well, I guess my question here is why we're not seeing the poll book off by 30,000 votes. That's not the case.
What did you guys do? Take it and do something crazy to it?
I'm just saying the numbers are not off by 30,000 votes. So
I know what
I saw. Are you saying that they're filling in?
I know what I saw. And I signed something saying that if I'm wrong, I can go to prison. Okay. Did you?
Okay, I'm just trying to ask you a legitimate question here. Yeah, let's let Representative Johnson ask his question, and then don't interrupt him. And then if you want to respond to it, that's fine. And did you have more, Representative?
Yeah, I guess I just want to keep following back up with the poll book. So are we saying that the poll book is either wildly off or that they are filling in names?
It's wildly off, and dead people voted, and illegals voted.
Okay.
So that's my answer.
Going back to the ruling from Judge Kenny, Timothy Kenny, he writes that your description of the events at the TCF Center does not square with any other affidavits.
Yeah.
He says that there are... Excuse me, I'm speaking.
Please, let's let the representative finish, and then you can...
He writes that there are no other reports of lost data or tabulating machines that jammed repeatedly every hour during the count. He also writes that neither Republican nor Democratic challengers nor city officials substantiate your version of these events. The allegations simply are not credible, is what Judge Kenny writes. So my question for you is, you're making claims here today that there's systematic fraud in what's going on in our elections. Are the courts also tied up in that fraud?
Let me tell you what I did by accident, okay? I gave Channel 7 an interview that they tied in to that and made me the witness that's uncredible. Guess what? There's going to be a couple behind me that are going to say the same thing I just said. And
the witness before you was also proven not credible as well by
oh,
the
no,
same
she
judge.
Wasn't, because she, was. She wasn't even there.
Representative
the
Camilleri, let's let her finish,
she has
please.
Talked. The very first time.
So I just want to understand... you know, I don't know what exactly all the things that are being talked about there are, but can you tell us what you said today is the truth? Is that correct?
Sir, I wrote a written affidavit. Yes, it is 100% true.
Okay, and did other people observe this?
Absolutely. And behind me, you're going to hear a couple.
Okay, and we'll hear from them.
And let me just state this. Mm-hmm. I was an IT worker on the stage. I was working with Dominion. I had no poll workers were not allowed on the stage. The data loss, nobody would have heard about that besides me, Samuel, and Nick. Okay? Mm-hmm. Just like nobody knows that Samuel went to the Chicago warehouse besides me, because I worked for Dominion.
Why is it that we're not having more people come forward? I mean, it seems like if there was all this widespread fraud that, you know, we'd have dozens and dozens of people.
I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. My life has been destroyed. My life has been completely destroyed because of this. I've lost family. I've lost friends. I've been threatened. My kids have been threatened. I've had to move. I've had to change my phone number. I've had to get rid of social media. Nobody wants to come forward. They're getting threatened. Their lives are getting ruined. I can't even get an actual job anymore. I can't. Because Democrats like to ruin your lives. That's why.
Yeah, this right here.
All right. So that was a hearing with Melissa Carone, who was a poll worker, who was alleging voter fraud in Michigan. And we heard two Democratic state representatives, Stephen Johnson and Representative Campolera, and Matt Hall, a Republican, asking her questions. Rudy Giuliani was at Carone's side during this event. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. What do you think? 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Leonard in St. Pete. Leonard, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi. I just want to say, as somebody who's been watching the election processes and a few recounts, and I've filmed and attended a few court hearings for the election integrity community, that the reason people are concerned, I guess, is because America has an extremely weak election auditing, monitoring, and basically observation process. So when Brian Corley comes on and says, you know, why are people complaining? Well, maybe it's because they're not allowed to observe in the counting room. They're not allowed to observe the ballot materials coming back from the precincts. They're not allowed to look at the proprietary source code. We have people that, you know, endorse electronic voting machines with no paper trail. We have the inability of any international organization to do their own audit or observation. So these fundamental problems should be resolved by both sides of Congress, and they've never really worked on them.
And Leonard, do you think that there was a conspiracy in this election?
Well, I'll tell you about the past ones.
Let's talk about this one, if you don't mind. Do you think there was a conspiracy during this election?
I have no idea.
Okay. And you know, there is a paper trail now. We do have paper ballots. that people mark.
In Florida, not in many other states.
Right, but in Florida we have paper ballots. And yeah, okay. Leonard, thank you.
You bet.
All right, great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. And Kent in Tampa wants to comment about my calling it a hearing. Kent, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, what's up?
All right, good job. Hey, so, you know, I don't know the particulars of the audio that you play, but I've heard in several cases where these little dog and pony shows that Giuliani has put on are called hearings, and they are not. You know, hearings have certain things about them, like, you know, being sworn in a judge and being, you know, subject to perjury, you know, to just have a bunch of people together to talk their tales.
Yeah, I think that certainly was true in Pennsylvania, where it was a dog and pony show. I think this was a little bit more balanced, where the Democrats were there in Michigan and were able to ask questions. Now, whether or not Ms. Caron was, whether she swore an oath before she testified, I do not know, and I'll have to look into it. But this is a little bit different than the Pennsylvania one, which definitely was a dog and pony show.
Right. The other thing is, I really salute Brian Corley for stepping up. And the other thing about that is, you know, Brian Corley has 67 other counterpoint, you know, people, elect supervisors in the state of Florida. And then nationwide, there are almost 4,000 counties. So that's a whole lot of people to, you know, somehow bribe. And then all the people that work for them, you know, that you can't pull off a conspiracy by yourself. So, I used to think that was a real weakness in our system, was this kind of decentralized election with different rules. But it's really almost like a strength, because, I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to get people to do things, but, you know, to get that many people to buy into something, even if it was legal, would be hard. And then to put them into an illegal situation. Now, I'm not saying they would have to swing every, you know, county in that, you know, you could select, but still, that's a lot.
Yeah, I agree. Kent, absolutely. If you have a team of 10 people and you have a mission to do something, not everybody in that team of 10 is going to carry out the mission as commanded or as directed. It just doesn't happen. That's the way humans work. So to think that 3,000 or 4,000 election supervisors' offices would all be involved in a vast conspiracy, absolutely right. You couldn't coordinate 3,000 or 4,000 different offices. The thing that I always wonder about is that if the Democrats did steal this election, why did they forget to steal the U.S. Senate? If the Democrats did steal this election, they shot themselves in the foot by not ensuring that their Senate candidates won a majority in the U.S. Senate. So I think that's the big problem for this conspiracy theory. Let's go to Rod in Pinellas Park. Rod, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Oh, I listened to that clip you just played from that gal. She sounded like she probably should be next to Rudy Giuliani. These people don't seem to be able to articulate their point very well, you know what I mean? And I do agree with the last caller and you. A conspiracy of that magnitude, it just seems almost impossible to me. I'm not saying it probably couldn't happen, I guess, but I would think the odds of that happening are almost astronomical. I saw that now he wants to fire Barr because he even came out and said that there were no widespread frauds that they could see at the Department of Justice, so he just keeps at that narrative, keeps saying it, people believe it, and I don't understand. I mean, that gal that was on your clip, she sounded like she was just kind of raving a little bit more than anything.
Yeah, and
else.
people should watch that clip just so they can get a better sense of her demeanor. You know, Rod, the other thing that's going on now is that there are people that support the president or who are calling on him to enact martial law and have a revote under martial law.
Yeah, that's it's crazy. I mean, his ego is just unbelievably huge. He cannot take any kind of a loss or any time. You know, these people, you know how Barr supported him so vehemently, and these people that have supported him so vehemently have come in now and said, well, you know, this isn't what's going on. This is not what we find. And the minute anybody says anything derogatory or contrary to what he says, they get fired, they're gone, and it's like, I just, I don't understand how people can see that.
Yeah, Rod, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. We got a lot of emails about this show. Terry writes regarding Joe Biden and what he should do next. I'm sorry, but I think we should wait for Biden to become president before criticisms and suggestions, especially with the transition being thwarted by Trump. First, give him a chance or let him get a try, writes Terry. And then Jeff writes, it's unusual to hear Trump getting some praise for something. As for a Biden administration, we can only hope for a more people-first agenda. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the Surly Feminists. They're coming up next right here on W.